Hello, everybody, and welcome to this, the latest episode of the Rewatch Project with Hannah and Mike. I am Mike, and stifling her first yawn of the evening over there is my always energetic wife, Hannah. How are you this evening?
I'm waiting on an iron infusion. You can't blame me for being tired.
I don't blame you. I wouldn't blame you for being tired, even if you were, Hannah. It's just quite natural.
It's become psychosomatic with the podcast starting, I think, as well. I could be fine all day and then you hit record and I want to yawn. I don't know what that says. But
I would get that whenever I would be reading one of our children a story.
Yeah.
It was just, yeah. But anyway, here we are.
Hannah, hi, everybody.
Hannah has a non-alcoholic beer. I have my Cerveza. I've got my... Vin Diesel special going on here.
It's all about family.
It is all about family. And yes, we're here talking about Twin Peaks. We were talking about the 8th episode of season 2 of Twin Peaks. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that episode, Hannah?
Sure can. This episode is called Drive with the Dead Girl.
Hey, do you know what?
What?
That's an unofficial title.
Why am I married to you?
That's a great question. You'll be driving with a dead man soon, won't you? That'll be the official title.
If you see me put on a pair of those sort of surgical type gloves and there's a record player just turning around, run.
Yeah, that's a good sign, isn't it? Or Spotify on a loop would probably be the... it's not quite as cinematic, is it?
Yeah. Right, so synopsis says, Donna and James wonder why Maddie left so suddenly. Spoiler alert, she did.
Yeah.
Norma's mother arrives with the news that she's married a new man, Ernie Niles. Cooper tells Leland they arrested Ben Horn for Laura's murder. It is directed by Caleb Deschanel and written by Scott Frost.
Alrighty, okay, looking forward to this one. A couple of quick bits of housekeeping before we get onto that, though. Firstly, a reminder that we appreciate feedback at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com, or alternatively, you can just leave comments on our YouTube channel. Please check out our friend shows, namely Chinstroker versus Punter, His Film, Her Movie, Film Bastards, The Good, The Bad and The Odd, Talk With That Rhythm podcast, and the Video Game Landfill. And we also appreciate reviews on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify. So, Hannah, do we have any feedback?
We have an email from our buddy Alex that says, Episode 7. Hi, guys. Just wanted to say that your analysis of Episode 7 of Twin Peaks Season 2 is one of the best I ever heard. A lot of the other ones kind of agonize over all of the details and symbology and what it might mean. I think you were dead on the money that it is more about the feeling of collective experience. Really hard to define, but easy to understand, as you say. Great stuff, Alex.
That's very kind.
Thank you, Alex. That's a lovely email to receive. What do you think? Do you think we got the vibe?
I mean, the symbology's there, if that's what you want to do. And I don't, there's, you know, nothing wrong with that. And I've done that myself as well. But I just think that episode in particular really kind of plays like music, you know. Yeah. and it's,
and I'm not smart enough to talk about the symbology.
Well, no, it's not a question of smart enough, it's a question of being a big enough geek and having so little in your life that you put the time in. And also I think a lot of it is, it's about having like-minded people to talk to about it, you know, and having those conversations.
Well, a lot of the time when we talk after the episodes, you know, things will occur as you and I are bouncing ideas off each other that won't have occurred when we've watched it.
Well, it's like when you're at work and you brainstorm, isn't it? You know, you come up with ideas. You know, when sometimes you'll go and you'll speak to your manager or whatever and you'll sound something out and then make a decision and it'll be clear in your mind, but your manager won't have said a word.
Yeah.
You know, because you've just, it was just the act of talking about something.
Yeah.
Kind of unpacks it. But I think that in the instance of that episode, it is very much a what it's to me is actually about is collective consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, again, I think maybe there's a little bit of that transcendental meditation doctrine in there. You know, the idea of the unified field, that's a TM thing, isn't it? And I feel like
trademark.
and you know, you see Cooper sort of looking up into the air and looking left and right and sensing this and the other characters. And I think that that's what this episode's about. This episode is about how, and it, you know, inevitably it sounds kind of hippy dippy when you talk about it, but it's this idea that we are all connected in some way.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And if
so
you look
the old 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
but it's also like if you look at like the other episodes that Lynch directed, like the pilot, you've got that kind of round robin of people finding out about Laura and that collective grief kind of spreading like an organism across the town. So that's clearly a predilection for him. But I think also there's an element of that episode where it's Lynch kind of, and I say this in the positive sense of the word, just wallowing in the artistry of the aesthetic of the show, just enjoying the music and the red curtains and the look of the roadhouse and the 50s rock and roll stuff with Donna and James. And He's just vibing out in the world of Twin Peaks, you know.
We're going to have to cover the castle at some point just so everyone knows about the vibe.
Yeah, although we are going to have to get past referencing it every time one of us uses the word vibe.
I know, but I can't help it.
Because I know, I'm saying this, I'm doing it as well, but the word vibe is inevitably going to come up a lot when we talk about Twin Peaks. So we are just going to have to move past that. Should we watch another episode?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, so we're going to watch episode 8. We are going to hit pause, and then we will come back and react and respond and review and riff on said episode when it has finished. So we will see you on the other side.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, and welcome to Film Bastards, a podcast where three friends, two of them married and two of them podcasting life partners, chat everything from new releases, trailers, news, and an eclectic mix of other film goodies, and many, many, many tangents. You can find them by searching your podcast provider or check them out on Twitter and Instagram by searching Film Bastards. You never know, you might like it. And if you don't, well, we don't really give a f***.
And we're back. But you know, says I. We have just finished.
Wipe extra.
We are, yes.
All right.
I'm editing that. Wish we need to do a medley because I've got all my favourite boy band voices. My favourite is still the Five. Baby, bring it on, bring it on. That's one of my favourite backing vocals because it's a slightly meat-heady one. Does that bit, isn't it?
The best one is the bad singing version of The Story of My Life.
Yeah. Oh yeah, man.
When it goes, come on.
And Marty Pello's it's written on the wind, it's everywhere I go. Yeah. There's so many. Yes, we are back. We have just finished watching the 8th episode of season 2 of Twin Peaks, the episode unofficially titled Drive with a Dead Girl. Hannah, thoughts on this episode?
It was funny actually rewatching it. Made me realise this is the episode I think of the most when I think of Twin Peaks.
Oh, interesting.
Specifically, Leland with the golf balls in the lounge, looking in the rearview mirror in his car when he gets pulled over by Cooper.
One and Bob's reflection.
Yeah.
Being there.
Ben and bro
Jerry,
Ben and Jerry. Yeah. Why don't I forget that? The throwback of them as kids watching the girl dance.
Oh yes, the flashlight dance.
Yeah. Those are all things that that I think of just naturally when people say Twin Peaks. Yeah. They come to mind. So it was, I'd sort of forgotten that they were all in one episode. Mm. Yeah, so obviously it holds a lot of significance for me, and I can understand why, because, you know, at this point, you know, the audience knows who the killer is,
yeah,
and you're exploring how Leland has kind of given himself over to Bob now.
Yeah.
There's no good guy, bad guy anymore. It's just all in one.
Bob's kind of running wild, isn't he?
He is. There's no Leland there.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting to see how that manifests. And the cockiness of him, you know, just, yeah, the cockiness that is obviously Bob,
yeah,
coming through is really interesting to watch. I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. What about you?
I think in some ways, this is probably the most underrated episode of Twin Peaks, and I think there's a number of reasons for that. I think it comes between two of the best regarded episodes of the series, so it kind of gets lost a little bit.
Mm.
But I think the thing that's interesting is that it feels like a different show, because the secret of Laura's murderer has been the engine of the show. And this episode feels kind of almost liberated,
yeah,
by the fact that the secret's revealed, in the same way that Bob feels liberated. And I think there's lots of great moments in this episode. But I think that because, a little bit like what I talked about in the last episode, about how we know it was mandated by ABC for them to reveal the murderer because they were worried that audiences were going to start becoming resentful.
Mm.
If it wasn't released, if the secret wasn't revealed, I should say. But I still feel that they could have, because spoiler alert, Cooper and the crew find out in the next episode.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like this, the new status quo of the show that's been established here, it's a shame they've only got one episode to do it, because it feels like this could have been the show for a while. But although it's a shame they didn't do that, that kind of makes this episode even more special, because it kind of condenses all of that. I mean, you and I talked a lot when we were covering Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. about how what the show would often do is it would have something that would seismically change what the show was, and then it would explore what they could do with that new normal by doing standalones within the kind of new format of the show.
Yeah.
And I almost feel like this episode is a one-off version of Twin Peaks doing that, of kind of like, what would the show Twin Peaks be like if it was that Columbo-esque thing of the audience know but Cooper doesn't? What would that look like? And again, I said, I think in the last episode, that I don't know that maybe our heroes learning who killed Laura was also part of that executive mandate that they had as well. It might not have been. Or maybe they just thought, hey, we don't want our lead characters to look stupid, you know, by the audience knowing.
Well, they lose their credibility by going down the wrong path for a long time if they were to draw it out. Plus, I like the way that because there is a short time between the audience finding out and our protagonists finding out, like there's a chaotic energy.
Yeah. And a sense of momentum.
Because of Leland sort of being Bob now, like Bob overtaking everything.
The only Leland that we're seeing now is Bob's impersonation of Leland based on what he knows of Leland.
But you see it in other ways in the episode, the chaos. Like the camera, when they find Maddie's body at the end,
it's a handheld, isn't it?
It's like a fucking Bourne movie.
And you see people looking into the camera, like it's a put there, sort of, you know. And Ben Horn as well, unraveling.
Yeah, like that whole energy It's everywhere in the episode. Well, and it's really quite interesting to see, you know, we talked in the last episode about the collective grief of the town. Mm. So now it's like the collective chaos.
And it's interesting now watching this after seeing season three, because what season three is about is you get a sense that there's this kind of rot set into Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
There's been an influx of really hard drugs, a much more darker criminalization of the town.
Mm.
And you see it manifesting itself.
Mm.
And so season three is almost like a season-long exploration of that idea of this collective experience. But no, you're absolutely right. That sense of anarchy and the idea that, you know, the genie's out of the bottle is manifesting itself across the town in the same way that grief and that sense of ethereal sadness that you saw in the last episode is as well. But also, what we've also got to mention is how great Ray Wise is in this.
He is fucking fantastic.
He gets to just go like almost like Jack Nicholson as the Joker.
The sweaty giggling is kind of amazing.
Well, the fact that he's crying and laughing at the same time. Yep.
Trying to look serious.
Yeah.
You know, trying to have that concerned face on him.
The thing that was amazing was I remember when I read Reflections, the book on Twin Peaks, you know how he's sweating in those scenes? He's kind of got his manic energy. They didn't spray water on him. So Ray Wise literally just made himself sweat.
Wow.
Through performance. It's just like the and apparently they said that there wasn't as much of that in the episode when it was on the page, but they were all just so amazed that he could go there and with that level of kind of theatricality.
Yeah.
He was, you know, and just what he's doing with his face and, you know, because there was always a realism to what he did before. But here, it's completely fantastical. The only comparison I can think of is characters like almost like a Loki, not Loki in the Marvel films, but the sort of the mythological figure of Loki and the Joker from Batman. That level of theatricality is what Ray Wise brings, but it's absolutely correct for the role. And
I just think it's a powerhouse performance.
Well, completely.
Did he win any awards for it?
No,
that's ridiculous.
Twin Peaks never really got recognition for acting. It was all about the quirkiness and the weirdness.
Quite dark on awards at the moment.
but I think that the performances in Twin Peaks are so diverse.
Mm.
In the stars, and sometimes, you know, within just one actor's performance, he is really, really great in those scenes.
It's something I admire, and I think it's a quality of an actor that I admire in a few different actors, their ability to, you know, like when they have to have more than one persona in the same person, like you see it in Fringe.
Brian Cranston can do that as well.
Yeah. Well,
John Noble
is amazing.
John Noble would have been a great
Anna Torv is amazing at it as well.
Yeah.
Just that being able to elicit sympathy and hatred all by just how their faces and how their body moves and the cadence of their voice, and you know, everything.
It sounds like a cliche, but it's being able to use their physicality as an instrument.
It's the mark of an exceptional actor.
Yeah, and the thing is, and what Ray Wise brings out is it is his sense of dread. Like the moment where he's in the Great Northern and he walks around the corner and he looks like he's crying, but he's actually laughing. And the way that you see Cooper kind of go to hurry, hang on, I'll be back in a minute, because Cooper's just feeling that there's something going on.
That's actually one thing I noticed a few times in the episode, like his sixth sense or whatever side, you know, his paranormal side has hooked into Bob without realizing it. Because if you notice,
he's whistling the same song, isn't it?
They're whistling the same song later on in the episode. He notices that Leland just something not right there. Yeah.
The way he's connecting to Mike as well.
Yeah, I hadn't noticed that last time, but it is really apparent that subconsciously he's kind of
he's intuiting, isn't he?
Yeah. And that was really special to see again.
But you feel the danger as well. Like when he walked around that corner to go and see Leland, we've seen the show before, so we know what does or doesn't happen.
Mm.
But there is still a feeling of like, no, Cooper, let it go, man. This is like kind of bigger than you.
Well, even when they pull the car over, you think that Leland's going to batter him with a golf club.
But it's almost as though you get the feeling, and this is why I compare him to the Joker as well, is that Bob is, Mike says, he's eager for fun. And so he's just kind of a chaos agent as well.
Yeah.
He likes the senses. He's a sort of dark sensualist. But at the same time, it's almost like you get the impression that he caved Cooper's head in with a golf club just to kind of see what would happen.
Mm.
You know, because he can probably just get out of there. I don't know what the rules are of how he is, but if he is this, interdimensional being or whatever it is, he could probably do whatever the hell he wants and be gone.
Yeah.
You know, so there is an element, and that's the Loki element, the trickster, the kind of dark jester kind of element. And like when he does the dance, when they walk away, he's kind of getting off on the risk-taking element of it and just the... and that gives it a kind of dark absurdism as well, which
he really loves the song about an animal as well.
Yeah, he's big on that, isn't he? He's
lambs eating ivy, and now he's got
Surrey with a fringe on top.
Yeah.
But and it's also worth mentioning that amongst all of this, of course, you get some great silly season two stuff. Like, you know, you'll get all the stuff with Lucy's sister, you get all the stuff with like Ernie Niles and all that. That's very season two, you know. That's very Dick Tremaine and the Save the Pine Weasel kind of, you know.
Our domino loving.
We'll get to that. Well, I mean, let's go through and see what we've missed, because I feel like this is a bit, we're getting to the point in the show now where I think our reviews of it are like the show itself in the way that it is a bit of a kaleidoscope, you know, so it's kind of hard to separate out. But again, the thing that I realise is Twin Peaks is such an ensemble that you do get clumps of episodes that focus on other people. Because, I mean, we haven't seen Major Briggs for a really long time. We haven't seen, you know, it's so, and you kind of, the fact that the show can be so awesome, but with an entire huge component of the show not there, and then they'll come back probably in a few episodes' time, and there'll be amazing stuff with them.
Yeah.
So we open up with a shot of the Palmer house and the sort of echo of screams on the soundtrack. And I like the way that when you see Leland playing golf, it's like, that's his new mad thing.
Yeah.
You know, we've had dancing, we've had singing, although singing and dancing are still lurking around a little bit. But golf is his new thing as well.
Yeah.
And that feels just like a sort of, although it's not directed by Lynch, a Lynchian touch. Just the idea of like a living room full of golf balls, that feels, you know, of a piece.
Yeah.
James and Donna come over. We see Bob in the mirror. I do find, as much as I enjoy this episode and a lot of other ones, I always find that whenever you see Bob or the little man or the giant or any of these figures in episodes that aren't directed by Lynch, which is rare, they never feel quite right. Like when you see Bob in the mirror here, there's something not off about it, but like the bit where like Lena's doing his tie-up, so you see Bob in his reflection going like this as well. Lynch wouldn't do that. And it's not that it's bad or anything like that, but I think that when you've watched enough hours of somebody's work, there's real subtleties that you're like, that's not quite.
Jinx.
Lynch wouldn't be that literal and that daylight about it.
He wouldn't be obvious about it.
Yeah.
He would be subtle,
yes. The opposite of that. So we see the body in the bag, in the boot of the car. Just the little touches, like the fact that he takes the roof down.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Bob would do that.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, Leland would probably be practical and think, well, you know, I'll put the air conditioning on. It's more comfortable, you know, sensible, you know, responsible citizen. Bob's like, nah, man, I've got a toy here. I'm going to play.
Top down.
And it's almost as though, you know, the whole him out in the car for a lot of the episode and, you know, the fact that the chosen title for the episode was Drive Your Dead Girl, it almost feels like Bob is taking Leland out for a test drive.
Yeah.
You know, literally himself. He's kind of like, all right, well.
Bob sort of knows he's coming to the end of the road.
Exactly. So he's kind of like, all right, I'm going to have a bit of fun before I go.
Yeah,
you know, I'm going to slam the door on the way out.
Yeah.
So he's kind of getting to do all the mad shit that he's had to hide and suppress. Because to him, it's probably a real burden to do that, you know, to have to suppress that. So he's kind of, I think, enjoying being allowed to let his freak flag fly a little bit.
I was just thinking that exact phrase.
It's really hard to say after 2 years as well. Oh, you didn't see? We're rocking the house.
Freak flag fly.
A freak flag fly.
We are very in tune tonight.
Yeah, we are, aren't we? We've got our Mendes, Sam Mendes together. So we see Ben and Jerry in the jail. I love the way that Jerry's just reading a book called Criminal Law. Like he's like a no-frills thing.
Yeah, it's really like, you know, the law for dummies.
Yeah, yeah. And he talks about how he was with Catherine. And again, this is such a classic Ben and Jerry scene, the way he's like, bunk beds. It's the same thing, the same part of their personality that wants to have baguettes.
Eat a big baguette,
was it a smoked cheese pig and cook heat marshmallows on the fire and all that. And they reminisce about a girl when they were at summer camp dancing with. And I love this scene. To me, this is what Twin Peaks does the best.
Whoever that is.
Oh, really? Okay. Because
very fluid.
I always thought when it was first on, I thought it was Sharon Fenn because the video quality was crap. And she just had that styling. But when you're watching in HD, no, it clearly isn't. She's just a different type. But I think that's just the Twin Peaks type, you know, the sweaters, pencil skirts, socks. You know, that's just the kind of the aesthetic of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
But the fact that the show will just stop and again indulge in its aesthetic and just play a really nice piece of music that Angela Badalamonte's written that, you know, is just in this scene. It feels like Twin Peaks. And it also tells you something about the characters. Like, you see that Ben and Jerry kind of hate themselves. You know, Jerry actually says, oh, what have we become?
Yeah.
I love that. It's a little film, you know.
I love that he finished last in his
it was like class of 200 or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, like, you know, you always think that with doctors and stuff, you know.
Yeah, were you one of the good ones?
Were you top of your class or were you at the bottom? Were you just squeaking through?
Were you helped through by your course leader because they wanted to maintain their annual batting average, you know? Because you get a lot of that, you know. Yeah. It's like, right, I will carry you to get over here.
I'll never forget going to the doctor once and he had to Google what my symptoms were and I was like, I think I might go to someone else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it could have been worse. You could have Yahooed it.
Ask Jeeves.
You're like, there's something better than that, mate. You know, yes, Jeeves. Well, Jeeves says that you know Jeeves isn't really a person, don't you? Like, yes. But I think that's a great little scene.
It's lovely.
And I think many of my favourite scenes in Twin Peaks are these pretty little musical scenes. Like the scene in the previous episode where Shelley is telling Norma she's going to have to leave.
Yeah.
And you've just got, it's just
got that lovely music.
Yeah, it is almost as though the music came first. I can completely picture David Lynch hearing a piece of music and that being the trigger for the idea, you know. And this feels like one of those scenes. It's almost like you hear the music and it sounds like a girl dancing with a flashlight. You know, it's just one of those things. So we see Lucy's sister meet Hawk. And I love his, some of my best friends are white people. Because that's something, was it Ronald Reagan? It was some famous politician attempting to be groovy, saying some of my best friends are black people. That was a famous quote.
Right.
And I can't remember who it was, but it became emblematic of just wrong-headed attempts at political correctness.
Yeah.
So I like the idea that even though the show is has been a little bit, you know, again, wrong-headed about the way that they use Hawk, they kind of have fun with it here. Mm. But again, there is complexity to that because so much of Twin Peaks is a genre exercise.
Yeah.
That you can't hand wave and say all of these elements are cool, these satirical, oh, we do it like this because it's done like that in these slightly dumber TV shows that we like to comment on, but then get funny about them doing it to this element.
Yeah.
But obviously with modern sensibility, as soon as cultural stuff comes into the situation, we all just freak the hell out a little bit.
Yeah.
Cooper talks about Mike and says that he's on his dictaphone and he's walking along with Truman, and he says, and it's weird seeing him do, and this is something else I don't think David Lynch would have done. Cooper's doing an update with Diane, walking along with Truman. And that feels weird because Cooper has only ever done those when he's on his own.
Mm.
And it feels like he wouldn't be kind of that antisocial or disrespectful to Truman to do that. It just seems like an odd thing. I understand why they needed to do that from a story perspective, but it is odd. But he talks about how Mike, or you know, Philip Gerard, but Mike as he's really known when his chemicals are withheld. He talks about how, you know, he may have been a seer in a past life, but in this world he's a shoe salesman who lives among the shadows. And this is where they see Leland dancing in the lobby.
Mm.
And it's just a great sequence because, I mean, ostensibly what you've got is Truman tells him that they've got Ben, and Leland-Bob plays it really well because his initial reaction is horror that he killed somebody thinking they killed Laura and it wasn't them, which is quite a smart way to play it.
Yeah.
You know, that incredulity is the way to go.
Yeah.
But and then we get that great, probably, I think, the best sequence in the episode, I'd say, where, you know, you see Ray Wise kind of laugh, crying, and, again, pulling these maniacal, clownish kind of faces.
Yeah, and sort of trying to keep it together enough, knowing that he's still being watched.
Yeah, well, it's like getting the giggles at a funeral.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of trying to make it look like it's tears, you know, and he plays it really well. And then on top of that, there's that mischievous layer that you were talking about, that kind of almost kind of getting off on the danger and the sort of almost the mocking them for not realising
that
he's doing it, you know. Mm. And the staging of it is really great, as the way that they play him leave the scene. And that, again, that, as I say, that sense of dread when Cooper walks around to him is really well executed.
Mm.
And adds to the fact that there is a real sense of momentum. And although, you know, I say it's a shame they didn't get to kind of milk this for a bit longer, what you do get by them not doing that is this real sense of things amping up that happened maybe two or three episodes ago is being sustained.
Yeah.
And although we're taking these little slice of life breaks to see Hank and Norma and the in-laws having dinner at the Great Northern, it's still this sense that
still ramping.
You know, yeah. You know that things have to come to a head because it's a 22 episode season. It would just be insane to try and maintain that.
Yeah.
For that, it would just be bad writing to try and maintain that for a long period of time. We see Jerry's shit education history laid out to him by Cooper. And I like the way that Cooper plays really it a little bit when they're talking about Laura, where he's like, come on, Ben, we're all adults, you know.
He's trying his best at good cop,
All right, bruv, come on, you know. We've all got pissed in our time and, you know, and bought a whorehouse, you know.
Yeah.
Who here hasn't? And I like the way...
Run the mill.
I like the way that Jerry's like, look, seriously, he's like, Ben, as your solicitor, as your brother, and as your friend, I seriously think you should get a better lawyer. Yeah. It's like, what a great piece of advice.
That's the most self-aware Jerry has ever been.
Because he's not under any illusions.
He knows he's a piece of
shit. And he doesn't look remotely offended.
No.
When Cooper lays it all out, he's like, yeah.
I suck.
Yeah. And so we get, we see Bobby listening to the tape of Leo and Ben.
Bobby is so far behind the eight ball trying to
blackmail Ben.
Doesn't even know he's like, in prison.
Yeah, join the club.
Yeah.
And I love the way as well, I've always thought about this scene, when, I can't remember the character's name now, Shelley walks into the kitchen and she's covered in, like, I don't know, the gruel or porridge or whatever that she's been feeding him. And Bobby, being Bobby, is getting all turned on. And he's like getting bits of the food and licking them. I thought it would have been great if after the scene she went, he spat that at me.
Yeah. Well, like, that's what I was thinking. Like, oh.
It's like, I mean, this isn't like melted chocolate dipped strawberries or like sexy ice cubes in 9.5 weeks kind of. This is like food being fed to an invalid. You know?
It'd be like you licking Weet-Bix off me when I used to feed the kids when they were babies.
Is that Farley's Rusks?
Ooh,
is that, it's like, ooh.
Ooh, pureed fruit.
Yeah. Ovaltine flavour. You know, it's just, blended carrots.
God, is that pureed chicken? Oh.
Yeah, it's the least sexy food scene that I think I've ever seen.
Not 9.5 weeks.
No. So we're introduced to Norma's mother, played by Jane Greer. Now, Jane Greer, actually, this is another classic case of Twin Peaks casting kind of cult Hollywood royalty because... And a lot of this is the timing of the show because, you know, it was made in the 90s. So if you're going to have older characters, you're going to have actors who were around in the 50s, which was kind of the golden age in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, she was a femme fatale in loads of the great art. I mean, she was in...
The great.
Paramedic, darling. In all of the great... I mean, I managed... What was the hard thing I said earlier on that I managed to get out?
Freak flag fly.
No, she was in.
I do like the fact that you said Dr. Hugh.
Dr. Hugh.
It really did make me giggle.
but she was in loads of the great film noir. She was in Out of the Past, you know, one of the all time great film noirs. And she was, you know, one of the classic husky femme fatales in that. And, but,
she does have Norma's mannerisms and stuff.
It is like funny, isn't it? Yeah, they've both got a similar...
I feel like they must have kind of studied each other. Like, I feel like she sort of is moving like Norma is and speaking in the same sort of quiet rhythm that Norma has.
Well, I mean, Peggy Lipton does feel a lot like an actress from that era.
Yeah.
In many
ways.
I can imagine her in black and white. And I think another element of that as well, out of just sheer necessity, is that does also feel like a bit of a nod to the 80s soap opera that this came out of, because they would do that. If you look at Dynasty, they would put in actors like Charlton Heston was in it, and Rock Hudson, you know, who these actors who are, you know, well past their prime, so, you know, crucially were affordable, but added a sense of old Hollywood glamour to the shows. And I don't think that was necessarily what Twin Peaks was trying to achieve. I think it was that they wanted the best actors for the roles, and often they were people who, you know, maybe were, you know, movie stars. You know, I mean, like Richard Beamer and, you know, and oh, I can't remember his name, like Russ Tamblyn, being, you know, great examples of that. And, you know, the judge from quite a recent episode too. But I do think an element of it is referencing the... kind of excessive nature of the modern soap opera, well, the then contemporaneous soap opera, and how they would often do casting like that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so we see Mike escape. I love the way he apologises to the guy who knocked him out. And I like the way as well that when the guy gets knocked out, he's not unconscious. He's just sort of like, because I was talking about this today, is apart from things like quicksand, I think one of the most damaging cliches in film and TV that warps my view of the world for years is the concept of people getting knocked out. Like, you know, somebody get hit on the head and they'll be it's like they're asleep. Yeah. And then they'll wake up and be like, oh gosh, you know, it's this head trauma. You know, it's like if you actually get hit on the head to the point where you are unconscious, that is something that could affect you for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Whereas in film and TV, particularly if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, it's shown as just being this completely like, oh, I'll knock someone out just so I can, you know, get out of here. They'll be fine.
Yeah.
So it's really nice to see somebody get knocked out and not actually be unconscious, but just look like they're disoriented and in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
You know, because that's the reality of it.
They're all very quiet, though. I can imagine if you got smacked over the head, you'd be very loud about it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It'd be full-on Lego foot kind of scream going on there.
Yeah.
Pete goes to Harry, and they exchange notes about Josie and realise that she was lying about Mr. Lee - her cousin Jonathan. Andy sees Lucy with a baby and seems to think that it's hers, which shows he doesn't quite understand the how it works.
And given the fact that, you know, you really have to remember that it's been like
a day and a half since you last saw her, probably.
Well, that, you know, the entirety of Twin Peaks to date has been about 2.5 weeks.
And Pete goes to Ben with a tape recorder. I'm sure you see tape recorders about 3 or 4 times in Twin Peaks, and I'm sure it's the same tape recorder. It's interesting that Pete's not even remotely bothered that Catherine's referencing her affair with Ben.
Well, because he always knew that that was going on.
Well, I
remember the sheriff references it. It might have been a Bookhouse Boys thing, but he references the, Catherine and Ben were together. It's like the worst kept secret in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
I
mean, it's never explicitly stated that Pete knew, but the impression that I get, I mean, he may have, but the impression that I get is that their marriage was so far gone that it was like, just throw that on the pile of problems. But it does seem that...
sort of like gone so far wrong and come round the other way.
Yeah. Well, right. It's almost as though Pete now is kind of intoxicated by her treachery and kind of maybe wants in a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, because I think...
sick of being walked all over.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think part of it is just the relief of having her back. He's kind of swept up.
Realising that there's still something, some feeling there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And also I think it's that she talked when she was trying to get him to help her at the end of season 2 about how, you know, he was this virile lumberjack who could scamper up a tree. Mm. And she was like the boss's daughter up in the mansion.
Yeah.
And it's all very Mills and Boone, you know, kind of. But then, you know, the reality of that 30 years later is that they're very different people.
Yeah.
You know, he likes to fish and, you know, she's got her mink oil. And it's, they just, those differences re-manifest themselves when you're not 25 and it's not all just a bit sexy, you know. And I think that what you're seeing here is that... his complicity with Catherine's kind of crazed soap operatic shenanigans is a kind of rejuvenating intoxication in their relationship, or maybe he perceives that that could be what it is.
Yeah.
You know, so I think he's just going along with it. And also I think that Josie was a stabilizing force in the house. So I think now she's gone, he's just got no, sort of moral barometer.
But also maybe feels quite let down by Josie just going with barely an explanation.
Well, yeah, it's almost like he's like, well, you know what?
Everyone else is...
acting like they're in a soap opera, so I may as well join
the cast.
Yeah. I like the way that when Ben freaks out, there's a couple of things I like about this scene. I like the fact that, first of all, he completely does actually lose control. But I also like the way that he does he pushes his tie up.
Yeah, I like that
too. He's trying to recenter and recompose, you know.
Yeah.
And my notes have gone crazy here. Give me a moment just to delete a few things.
It reminded me of in the last episode when he's smoothing his jacket down when they're trying to arrest him.
Yeah. Mm. We get the moment you referenced earlier on when Leland is singing Sorry with a Fringe on Top in his car,
mm-hmm.
and Cooper's whistling the same song. And this is the thing where I've got the quote from Mike from much earlier in the show, where he talks about how, like, you know, Bob likes the pleasures and he's eager for fun,
mm.
you know. And this is what we're seeing here, he's eager for fun. He's taking Leland out for a joyride. Mm. And this is where he tells Cooper that he remembered something, and he mentions the diary. So obviously what he's doing there is I think Bob is thinking, hey, well, you know what, if they're going after Ben, let's, you know, because Leland would know Ben enough that if he wanted to contrive some kind of incrimination.
Yeah, if he wanted to implicate him, yeah, he absolutely could.
He has the knowledge to do that, you know, somewhat realistically. Mm. We see Mike sort of sniffing around Ben and saying, this is not Bob.
Mm.
And there's the great moment when Jerry's like, look, charge my client or let him go.
Mm.
And they're like, right, we're charging you. And Ben's like, great job, Jerry. Like, you know, thanks for that. And it is interesting that when Cooper's like, look, you know, I don't think he's here. You know, Truman does say, look, you know, I've backed you the whole time, but we've got hard evidence.
Mm.
And it's like Cooper immediately is like, yep, nope, you're right. Mm. Sorry. You know, this is your territory.
Which kind of conflicts with, you know, the speech he gave in the pilot about this is FBI. I'm running this investigation. You need to do what I say.
Yeah, but Truman would still have to be the arresting officer.
Yeah, yeah.
Just from that.
Well, I think.
And I think Cooper's a realist.
I don't think it's a fault of the, like, I don't think it's a continuity problem. I think it says more about how their relationship has developed over the course of the fortnight they've been together.
Yeah.
That he gives Truman more, he gives weight to his opinion.
Yeah.
So he's happy for him to take the lead and say that he doesn't agree. Like, Cooper values it.
And it's almost as though Cooper's sort of spiritual investigation has always kind of ran adjacent to the mainstream sort of
facts,
investigative one. So we see Ernie and Hank. We see the domino bolo tie, which I'm going to be on Etsy later on, see if it's there. It's nice to see that come back. I thought they'd forgotten about the domino. It was a nice touch. And I'm trying to imagine Hank buying that. Or do you think he had it commissioned?
Oh, I think it was commissioned.
Yeah.
He's probably got a belt buckle.
Maybe he made it in prison. Maybe he's got like a belt, like a domino belt.
Mm-hmm.
All dominoes.
Like a Howard Wolowitz style belt buckle.
Or maybe like a domino bandolier. Kind of like
domino braces.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it almost feels a little bit like, do you remember in the 80s how session keyboard players would have like a keyboard tie?
Oh, yeah.
It feels like, I could almost imagine Paul Schaefer in David Letterman's band wearing a domino bolo tie. It feels like something a session musician would wear, you know. Like somebody who's not in a real band, but he's kind of hired to be in bands would wear. Mm. I love the fact that Cooper's got a gigantic piece of pie next to his bed. I mean, the horrible, like, if I did that, I'd just be having galloping diarrhea at like 4 o'clock in the morning. Like, but then again, you know, you're in a hotel, you got ensuite, why not?
And sharing with anyone.
Well, yeah, quite. And it's the sense that things are drawing in are there whenever an episode gets near its end and it's Cooper in the Great Northern at night, it always feels like, again, things are starting to feel a little bit liminal. And he's talking to, the scene starts with him talking to Diane saying, you know, that there's not a star in the sky tonight. And he's saying that I'm close, and the door, you know, somebody knocks on the door. I love the way he takes his gun as well. He's learned from his mistakes. And it's Audrey in the scene. And it's a really nice scene because she's talking about how her dad's ashamed of her, and Cooper's like, he's not, you know. And I think Cooper believes it. I think Cooper does believe that deep down, Ben does love her. He's just a man-child who has never had to actually have any real responsibility in his life, you know.
And has given in to his base desires.
Yeah, exactly. It's just it's a weakness.
It is a weakness.
And the phone goes and he says, you know, go to your room and lock the door. And again, I love it when Twin Peaks gets like this. When shit gets serious in Twin Peaks, you really feel it, you know.
Yeah.
And they find the body of Maddie wrapped in plastic. And again, Cheryl Lee must be like, all right, get the frigging plastic on me again, you know. Because she appeared on the cover of Rolling Stone. But she was all glammed up, smoking a cigarette, like wrapped in plastic. It's this really awesome kind of iconic picture that I always remember. And Rolling Stone always did the coolest covers.
Yeah.
When The X-Files started, there's a famous one of Mulder and Scully, of David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson in bed together smoking cigarettes. Mm. I always remember that one as well. They would always do these things that kind of spun the thing. But anyway, I'd done a tangent at the end. Any final thoughts on this episode before we wrap things up?
Just loved it, and I'm really looking forward to the next one. There's, I think, you know, everyone will know the most iconic scene in the next episode. Yeah. That is probably the only other thing that I think about all the time.
Yeah,
as being.
Yeah, I mean, the next episode is one that I think people are often surprised to find out isn't directed by David Lynch.
Yeah,
because. And I think when you know it isn't and you're watching it, it's apparent, but it's a very strong episode. Mm. For a lot of people, it's one of their favourite episodes of the show. There's a lot to talk about in that one, that's for sure. So we will get to that. Before you tell our listeners a little bit about that, I would just remind everybody that we appreciate feedback, which can be sent to us either through email at rewatchprojectpodcast@gmail.com, or you can leave us comments on our YouTube page. Check out our friend shows. We are on Instagram and Twitter at rewatchproj. That's rewatch proj. If you do listen to us on YouTube, please remember to like and subscribe. We're almost up to 300 subscribers now.
Woo-hoo.
So we're moving on up, which is good. I think once you hit 500, you start getting featured in more prominent positions in YouTube, so it would be great to get to that. And what I've seen a lot is once you hit 500, it can kind of snowball a little bit from there, so that would be awesome. And when you get to 1,000, this would excite our daughter, you get sent one of those silver plaques by YouTube.
That would be living.
Yeah.
Our daughter's bedroom.
But maybe we could tell her it's for her channel, and then she'll hear this when she's like 30. At least I'll be dead by then, and she'll hate me from beyond the grave because of that.
But you better not be dead by then. It's only 20 years time.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Let's see how the rest of the night goes, shall we? So we do appreciate
quite like having you around.
And but if you do listen to us on YouTube, or if you listen to the regular version of the podcast, there are very quick and easy and, most importantly, free ways that you can support the podcast. One way is feedback.
That's absolutely a great motivator.
And the other way is just to subscribe or like or share. So if you could do one or all of those things, it would be really helpful and does not go unnoticed. So what's the next episode we're talking about, Hannah?
The next episode is called Arbitrary Law. Synopsis says, Albert returns to examine Maddie. Cooper asks for 24 hours to finish his case. James and Donna reaffirm their love. Andy accidentally leads Donna and Cooper back to Mrs. Tremond's house. It is directed by Tim Hunter and written by Mark Frost, Hayley Parton, Harley Payton, and Robert Engels. Bring it on.
Cool. Looking forward to that one. Okay, so join us for that, and we will see you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.